Chapter 43 Langdon stood motionless at the Pope's bulletproof window and gazed down at the bustle of media trailers in St. Peter's Square. The eerie phone conversation had left him feeling turgid, distended somehow, not himself. The Illuminati, like a serpent from the forgotten depths of history, had risen and wrapped themselves around an ancient foe. No demands, no negotiation, just retribution. Demonically simple. Squeezing. A revenge 400 years in the making. It seemed that after centuries of persecution, science had bitten back. The Camerlengo stood at his desk, staring blankly at the phone. Olivetti was the first to break the silence. "Carlo," he said, using the Camerlengo's first name and sounding more like a weary friend than an officer. "For 26 years, I have sworn my life to the protection of this office. It seems tonight I am dishonored." The Camerlengo shook his head. "You and I serve God in different capacities, but service always brings honor. These events, I can't imagine how this situation..." Olivetti looked overwhelmed. "You realize we have only one possible course of action. I have a responsibility for the safety of the College of Cardinals. I fear that responsibility was mine, Signore." "Then your men will oversee the immediate evacuation." "Signore, other options can be exercised later. A search for this device, a manhunt for the missing cardinals and their captors. But first the cardinals must be taken to safety. The sanctity of human life weighs above all. Those men are the foundation of this church." "You suggest we cancel conclave right now?" "Do I have a choice?" "What about your charge to bring a new pope?" The young chamberlain sighed and turned to the window, his eyes drifting out onto the sprawl of Rome below. "His Holiness once told me that a pope is a man torn between two worlds, the real world and the divine. He warned that any church that ignored reality would not survive to enjoy the divine." His voice sounded suddenly wise for its years. "The real world is upon us tonight. We would be vain to ignore it. Pride and precedent cannot overshadow reason." Olivetti nodded, looking impressed. "I have underestimated you, Signore." The Camerlengo did not seem to hear. His gaze was distant on the window. "I will speak openly, Signore. The real world is my world. I immerse myself in its ugliness every day, such that others are unencumbered to seek something more pure. Let me advise you on the present situation. It is what I am trained for. Your instincts, though worthy, could be disastrous." The Camerlengo turned. Olivetti sighed. "The evacuation of the College of Cardinals from the Sistine Chapel is the worst possible thing you could do right now." The Camerlengo didn't look indignant, only at a loss. "What do you suggest?" "Say nothing to the cardinals. Seal conclave. It will buy us time to try other options." The Camerlengo looked troubled. "Are you suggesting I lock the entire College of Cardinals on top of a time bomb?" "Yes, Signore. For now. Later, if need be, we can arrange evacuation." The Camerlengo shook his head. "Postponing the ceremony before it starts is grounds alone for an inquiry. But after the doors are sealed, nothing intervenes. Conclave procedure obligates..." "Real world, Signore. You're in it tonight. Listen closely." Olivetti spoke now with the efficient rattle of a field officer. "Marching 165 cardinals unprepared and unprotected into Rome would be reckless. It would cause confusion and panic in some very old men, and frankly, one fatal stroke this month is enough." One fatal stroke. The commander's words recalled the headlines Langdon had read over dinner with some students in the Harvard Commons. "Pope suffers stroke, dies in sleep." "In addition," Olivetti said, "the Sistine Chapel is a fortress. Although we don't advertise the fact, the structure is heavily reinforced and can repel any attack short of missiles. As preparation, we searched every inch of the chapel this afternoon, scanning for bugs and other surveillance equipment. The chapel is clean, a safe haven, and I am confident the antimatter is not inside. There is no safer place those men can be right now. We can always discuss emergency evacuation later, if it comes to that. Langdon was impressed. Olivetti's cold, smart logic reminded him of Kohler. Commander, Vittoria said, her voice tense. There are other concerns. Nobody has ever created this much antimatter. The blast radius, I can only estimate. Some of surrounding Rome may be in danger. If the canister is in one of your central buildings or underground, the effect outside these walls may be minimal. But if the canister is near the perimeter, in this building, for example... She glanced warily out the window at the crowd in St. Peter's Square. "I am well aware of my responsibilities to the outside world," Olivetti replied. "And it makes this situation no more grave. The protection of this sanctuary has been my sole charge for over 2 decades. I have no intention of allowing this weapon to detonate." Camerlengo Ventresca looked up. "You think you can find it?" "Let me discuss our options with some of my surveillance specialists. There is a possibility, if we kill power to Vatican City, that we can eliminate the background RF and create a clean enough environment to get a reading on that canister's magnetic field." Vittoria looked surprised, and then impressed. "You want to black out Vatican City?" "Possibly. I don't yet know if it's possible, but it is one option I want to explore." "The cardinals would certainly wonder what happened," Vittoria remarked. Olivetti shook his head. "Conclaves are held by candlelight. The cardinals would never know. After conclave is sealed, I could pull all except a few of my perimeter guards and begin a search. 100 men could cover a lot of ground in 5 hours."
4 hours, Vittoria corrected. "I need to fly the canister back to CERN. Detonation is unavoidable without recharging the batteries."
"There's no way to recharge here?" Vittoria shook her head.
"The interface is complex. I'd have brought it if I could."
4 hours, then," Olivetti said, frowning. "Still time enough. Panic serves no one. Signore, you have 10 minutes. Go to the chapel. Seal conclave. Give my men some time to do their job. As we get closer to the critical hour, we will make the critical decisions."
Langdon wondered how close to the critical hour Olivetti would let things get. The Camerlengo looked troubled.
"But the college will ask about the preferiti, especially about Baja, where they are."
"Then you will have to think of something, signore. Tell them you served the 4 cardinals something at tea that disagreed with them."
The Camerlengo looked riled.
"Stand on the altar of the Sistine Chapel and lie to the College of Cardinals?"
"For their own safety.
Una bugia veniale, a white lie.
Your job will be to keep the peace."
Olivetti headed for the door.
"Now, if you will excuse me, I need to get started."
"Comandante," the Camerlengo urged, "we cannot simply turn our backs on missing cardinals."
Olivetti stopped in the doorway.
"Baja and the others are currently outside our sphere of influence. We must let them go, for the good of the whole. The military calls it triage."
"Don't you mean abandonment?"
His voice hardened.
"If there were any way, signore, any way in heaven to locate those 4 cardinals, I would lay down my life to do it. And yet..."
He pointed across the room at the window, where the early evening sun glinted off an endless sea of Roman rooftops.
"Searching a city of 5 million is not within my power. I will not waste precious time to appease my conscience in a futile exercise. I'm sorry."
Vittoria spoke suddenly.
"But if we caught the killer, couldn't you make him talk?"
Olivetti frowned at her.
"Soldiers cannot afford to be saints, Miss Vitra. Believe me, I empathize with your personal incentive to catch this man."
"It's not only personal," she said. "The killer knows where the antimatter is, and the missing cardinals. If we could somehow find him..."
"Play into their hands?"
Olivetti said. Believe me, removing all protection from Vatican City in order to stake out hundreds of churches is what the Illuminati hope we will do, wasting precious time and manpower when we should be searching. Or, worse yet, leaving the Vatican Bank totally unprotected, not to mention the remaining cardinals. The point hit home. How about the Roman police? The Camerlengo asked. We could alert citywide enforcement of the crisis, enlist their help in finding the cardinal's captor. Another mistake, Olivetti said. You know how the Roman carabinieri feel about us. We'd get a half-hearted effort of a few men in exchange for their selling our crisis to the global media. Exactly what our enemies want. We'll have to deal with the media soon enough as it is. I will make your cardinals media luminaries, Langdon thought, recalling the killer's words. The first cardinal's body appears at 8 o'clock. Then one every hour. The press will love it. The Camerlengo was talking again, a trace of anger in his voice. Commander, we cannot in good conscience do nothing about the missing cardinals. Olivetti looked the Camerlengo dead in the eye. The prayer of St. Francis, Signore. Do you recall it? The young priest spoke the single line with pain in his voice. God, grant me strength to accept those things I cannot change. Trust me. Olivetti said, this is one of those things. Then he was gone. Chapter 44. The central office of the British Broadcast Corporation, BBC, is in London, just west of Piccadilly Circus. The switchboard rang, and a junior content editor picked up.
BBC, she said, stubbing out her Dunhill cigarette.
The voice on the line was raspy, with a Mideast accent.
I have a breaking story your network might be interested in.
The editor took out a pen and a standard lead sheet.
Regarding?
The papal election.
She frowned wearily. The BBC had run a preliminary story yesterday to mediocre response. The public, it seemed, had little interest in Vatican City.
What's the angle?
Do you have a TV reporter in Rome covering the election?
I believe so.
I need to speak to him directly.
I'm sorry, but I cannot give you that number without some idea.
There is a threat to the conclave. That is all I can tell you.
The editor took notes.
Your name?
My name is immaterial.
The editor wasn't surprised. And you have proof of this claim?
I do.
I would be happy to take the information, but it is not our policy to give out our reporters' numbers unless...
I understand. I will call another network. Thank you for your time. Goodbye.
Just a moment, she said. Can you hold?
The editor put the caller on hold and stretched her neck. The art of screening out potential crank calls was by no means a perfect science, but this caller had just passed the BBC's 2 tacit tests for authenticity of a phone source. He had refused to give his name, and he was eager to get off the phone. Hacks and glory hounds usually whined and pleaded. Fortunately for her, reporters lived in eternal fear of missing the big story, so they seldom chastised her for passing along the occasional delusional psychotic. Wasting 5 minutes of a reporter's time was forgivable. Missing a headline was not. Yawning, she looked at her computer and typed in the keywords Vatican City. When she saw the name of the field reporter covering the papal election, she chuckled to herself. He was a new guy the BBC has just brought up from some trashy London tabloid to handle some of the BBC's more mundane coverage. Editorial had obviously started him at the bottom rung. He was probably bored out of his mind, waiting all night to record his live 10-second video spot. He would most likely be grateful for a break in the monotony. The BBC content editor copied down the reporter's satellite extension in Vatican City. Then, lighting another cigarette, she gave the anonymous caller the reporter's number. Chapter 45.
It won't work,
Vittoria said, pacing the Pope's office. She looked up at the Camerlengo. Even if the Swiss Guard team can filter electronic interference, they will have to be practically on top of the canister before they detect any signal. And that's if the canister is even accessible, unenclosed by other barriers. What if it's buried in a metal box somewhere on your grounds, or up in a metal ventilating duct? There's no way they'll trace it. And what if the Swiss Guards have been infiltrated? Who's to say the search will be clean? The Camerlengo looked drained.
What are you proposing, Miss Vetra?
Vittoria felt flustered.
Isn't it obvious? I am proposing, sir, that you take other precautions immediately. We can hope against all hope that the commander's search is successful. At the same time, look out the window. Do you see those people? Those buildings across the piazza? Those media vans? The tourists? They are quite possibly within range of the blast. You need to act now.
The Camerlengo nodded vacantly. Vittoria felt frustrated. Olivetti had convinced everyone there was plenty of time. But Vittoria knew if news of the Vatican predicament leaked out, the entire area could fill with onlookers in a matter of minutes. She had seen it once outside the Swiss Parliament building. During a hostage situation involving a bomb, thousands had congregated outside the building to witness the outcome. Despite police warnings that they were in danger, the crowd packed in closer and closer. Nothing captured human interest like human tragedy.
"Signore,"
Vittoria urged, "the man who killed my father is out there somewhere. Every cell in this body wants to run from here and hunt him down. But I am standing in your office because I have a responsibility to you and others. Lives are in danger, signore. Do you hear me?" The Camerlengo didn't answer. Vittoria could hear her own heart racing. Why couldn't the Swiss Guard trace that damn caller? The Illuminati assassin is the key. He knows where the antimatter is. Hell, he knows where the cardinals are. Catch the killer, and everything is solved.
Vittoria sensed she was starting to come unhinged. An alien distress she recalled only faintly from childhood. The orphanage years. Frustration with no tools to handle it.
You have tools, she told herself. You always have tools. But it was no use. Her thoughts intruded, strangling her. She was a researcher and a problem solver, but this was a problem with no solution. What data do you require? What do you want? She told herself to breathe deeply. But for the first time in her life, she couldn't. She was suffocating.
Langdon's head ached, and he felt like he was skirting the edges of rationality. He watched Vittoria and the Camerlengo, but his vision was blurred by hideous images, explosions, press warming, cameras rolling, 4 branded humans. Shaitan, Lucifer, bringer of light, Satan. He shook the fiendish images from his mind. Calculated terrorism, he reminded himself, grasping at reality. Planned chaos. He thought back to a Radcliffe seminar he had once audited while researching Praetorian symbolism. He had never seen terrorists the same way since.
Terrorism, the professor had lectured, has a singular goal. What is it?
Killing innocent people? A student ventured.
Incorrect. Death is only a byproduct of terrorism.
A show of strength?
No. A weaker persuasion does not exist.
To cause terror.
Concisely put. Quite simply, the goal of terrorism is to create terror and fear. Fear undermines faith in the establishment. It weakens the enemy from within, causing unrest in the masses. Write this down. Terrorism is not an expression of rage. Terrorism is a political weapon. Remove a government's facade of infallibility, and you remove its people's faith.
Loss of faith. Is that what this was all about?
Langdon wondered how Christians of the world would react to cardinals being laid out like mutilated dogs. If the faith of a priest did not protect him from the evils of Satan, what hope was there for the rest of us?
Langdon's head was pounding louder now, tiny voices playing tug-of-war. Faith does not protect you. Medicine and airbags, those are things that protect you. God does not protect you. Intelligence protects you. Enlightenment. Put your faith in something with tangible results. How long has it been since someone walked on water? Modern miracles belong to science. Computers, vaccines, space stations, even the divine miracle of creation. Matter from nothing, in a lab. Who needs God? No, science is God. The killer's voice resonated in Langdon's mind. Midnight. Mathematical progression of death. Sacrifici vergini nell'altare di scienza. Then suddenly, like a crowd dispersed by a single gunshot, the voices were gone. Robert Langdon bolted to his feet. His chair fell backward and crashed on the marble floor. Vittoria and the Camerlengo jumped.
I missed it, Langdon whispered, spellbound. It was right in front of me.
Missed what? Vittoria demanded. Langdon turned to the priest. Father, for 3 years I have petitioned this office for access to the Vatican archives. I have been denied 7 times.
Mr. Langdon, I'm sorry, but this hardly seems the moment to raise such complaints.
I need access immediately. The 4 missing cardinals, I may be able to figure out where they're going to be killed.
Vittoria stared, looking certain she had misunderstood. The Camerlengo looked troubled, as if he were the brunt of a cruel joke.
You expect me to believe this information is in our archives?
I can't promise I can locate it in time, but if you let me in...
Mr. Langdon, I am due in the Sistine Chapel in 4 minutes. The archives are across Vatican City.
You're serious, aren't you? Vittoria interrupted, staring deep into Langdon's eyes, seeming to sense his earnestness.
"Hardly a joking time," Langdon said.
"Father," Vittoria said, turning to the Camerlengo, "if there's a chance, any at all, of finding where these killings are going to happen, we could stake out the locations and—"
"But the archives," the Camerlengo insisted. "How could they possibly contain any clue?"
"Explaining it," Langdon said, "will take longer than you've got. But if I'm right, we can use the information to catch the Hashashin."
The Camerlengo looked as though he wanted to believe, but somehow couldn't.
Christianity's most sacred codices are in that archive, treasures I myself am not privileged enough to see.
I am aware of that.
Access is permitted only by written decree of the curator and the Board of Vatican Librarians.
Or, Langdon declared, by papal mandate.
It says so in every rejection letter your curator ever sent me.
The Camerlengo nodded.
Not to be rude, Langdon urged, but if I'm not mistaken, a papal mandate comes from this office. As far as I can tell, tonight you hold the trust of his station. Considering the circumstances...
The Camerlengo pulled a pocket watch from his cassock and looked at it.
Mr. Langdon, I am prepared to give my life tonight. Quite literally, to save this church.
Langdon sensed nothing but truth in the man's eyes.
This document, the Camerlengo said, do you truly believe it is here, and that it can help us locate these 4 churches?
I would not have made countless solicitations for access if I weren't convinced.
Italy is a bit far to come on a lark when you make a teacher's salary. The document you have is an ancient...
Please, the Camerlengo interrupted. Forgive me. My mind cannot process any more details at the moment. Do you know where the secret archives are located?
Langdon felt a rush of excitement.
Just behind the Santa Ana Gate.
Impressive. Most scholars believe it is through the secret door behind St. Peter's throne.
No. That would be the Archivio della Reverenda di Fabrica di San Pietro.
A common misconception.
A library docent accompanies every entrant at all times. Tonight the docents are gone. What you are requesting is carte blanche access. Not even our cardinals enter alone. I will treat your treasures with the utmost respect and care. Your librarians will find not a trace that I was there.
Overhead, the bells of St. Peter's began to toll. The Camerlengo checked his pocket watch.
I must go.
He paused a taut moment and looked up at Langdon.
I will have the Swiss Guard meet you at the archives. I am giving you my trust, Mr. Langdon. Go now.
Langdon was speechless. The young priest now seemed to possess an eerie poise. Reaching over, he squeezed Langdon's shoulder with surprising strength.
I want you to find what you are looking for, and find it quickly.
Chapter 46. The secret Vatican archives are located at the far end of the Borgia courtyard, directly up a hill from the Gate of Santa Anna. They contain over 20,000 volumes, and are rumored to hold such treasures as Leonardo da Vinci's missing diaries, and even unpublished books of the Holy Bible. Langdon strode powerfully up the deserted Via della Fondamenta toward the archives, his mind barely able to accept that he was about to be granted access. Vittoria was at his side, keeping pace effortlessly. Her almond-scented hair tossed lightly in the breeze, and Langdon breathed it in. He felt his thoughts straying, and reeled himself back. Vittoria said,
"You going to tell me what we're looking for?"
"A little book written by a guy named Galileo." She sounded surprised.
"You don't mess around. What's in it?"
"It's supposed to contain something called Il Segno."
"The sign?"
"Sign, clue, signal. Depends on your translation."
"Sign to what?"
Langdon picked up the pace. "A secret location. Galileo's Illuminati needed to protect themselves from the Vatican, so they founded an ultra-secret Illuminati meeting place here in Rome. They called it the Church of Illumination." "Pretty bold calling a satanic lair a church." Langdon shook his head. "Galileo's Illuminati were not the least bit satanic. They were scientists who revered enlightenment. Their meeting place was simply where they could safely congregate and discuss topics forbidden by the Vatican. Although we know the secret lair existed, to this day nobody has ever located it."
"Sounds like the Illuminati know how to keep a secret."
"Absolutely. In fact, they never reveal the location of their hideaway to anyone outside the Brotherhood. This secrecy protected them, but it also posed a problem when it came to recruiting new members."
"They couldn't grow if they couldn't advertise," Vittoria said, her legs and mind keeping perfect pace.
"Exactly." "Word of Galileo's Brotherhood started to spread in the 1630s. And scientists from around the world made secret pilgrimages to Rome, hoping to join the Illuminati, eager for a chance to look through Galileo's telescope and hear the master's ideas. Unfortunately, though, because of the Illuminati's secrecy, scientists arriving in Rome never knew where to go for the meetings or to whom they could safely speak. The Illuminati wanted new blood, but they couldn't afford to risk their secrecy by making their whereabouts known." Vittoria frowned.
"Sounds like a situazione senza soluzione."
"Exactly. A catch-22, as we would say."
"So what did they do?"
"They were scientists. They examined the problem and found a solution. A brilliant one, actually. The Illuminati created a kind of ingenious map, directing scientists to their sanctuary." Vittoria looked suddenly skeptical and slowed. "A map? Sounds careless. If a copy fell into the wrong hands..."
"It couldn't," Langdon said. "No copies existed anywhere. It wasn't the kind of map that fit on paper. It was enormous. A blaze trail of sorts across the city."
Vittoria slowed even further. "Arrows painted on sidewalks?"
"In a sense, yes, but much more subtle. The map consisted of a series of carefully concealed symbolic markers placed in public locations around the city,
One marker led to the next and the next, a trail, eventually leading to the Illuminati lair. Vittoria eyed him askance. "Sounds like a treasure hunt." Langdon chuckled. "In a manner of speaking, it is. The Illuminati called their string of markers the Path of Illumination, and anyone who wanted to join the Brotherhood had to follow it all the way to the end, a kind of test." "But if the Vatican wanted to find the Illuminati," Vittoria argued, "couldn't they simply follow the markers?" "No, the path was hidden. A puzzle, constructed in such a way that only certain people would have the ability to track the markers and figure out where the Illuminati church was hidden. The Illuminati intended it as a kind of initiation, functioning not only as a security measure, but also as a screening process to ensure that only the brightest scientists arrived at their door." "I don't buy it. In the 1600s, the clergy were some of the most educated men in the world. If these markers were in public locations, certainly there existed members of the Vatican who could have figured it out." "Sure," Langdon said, "if they had known about the markers, but they didn't. And they never noticed them because the Illuminati designed them in such a way that the clerics would never suspect what they were. They used a method known in symbology as dissimulation. Camouflage." Langdon was impressed. "You know the term?" "Dissimulazione," she said. "Nature's best defense. Try spotting a trumpet fish floating vertically in seagrass." "Okay," Langdon said. "The Illuminati used the same concept. They created markers that faded into the backdrop of ancient Rome. They couldn't use ambigrams or scientific symbology because it would be far too conspicuous. So they called on an Illuminati artist, the same anonymous prodigy who had created their ambigrammatic symbol, Illuminati, and they commissioned him to carve 4 sculptures." "Illuminati sculptures?" "Yes, sculptures with 2 strict guidelines. First, the sculptures had to look like the rest of the artwork in Rome, artwork that the Vatican would never suspect belonged to the Illuminati." "Religious art?" Langdon nodded, feeling a tinge of excitement, talking faster now. "And the second guideline was that the 4 sculptures had to have very specific themes. Each piece needed to be a subtle tribute to one of the 4 elements of science." "4 elements?" Vittoria said. "There are over 100. "Not in the 1600s, Langdon reminded her. "Early alchemists believed the entire universe was made up of only 4 substances, earth, air, fire, and water." "The early cross," Langdon knew, "was the most common symbol of the 4 elements, 4 arms representing earth, air, fire, and water. Beyond that, though, there existed literally dozens of symbolic occurrences of earth, air, fire, and water throughout history. The Pythagorean cycles of life, the Chinese Hong Fan, the Jungian male and female rudiments, the quadrants of the zodiac. Even the Muslims revered the 4 ancient elements, although in Islam they were known as squares, clouds, lightning, and waves. For Langdon, though, it was a more modern usage that always gave him chills, the Masons' 4 mystic grades of absolute initiation: earth, air, fire, and water." Vittoria seemed mystified. "So this Illuminati artist created 4 pieces of art that looked religious, but were actually tributes to earth, air, fire, and water?" "Exactly," Langdon said, quickly turning up Via Sentinel toward the archives. "The pieces blended into a sea of religious artwork all over Rome. By donating the artwork anonymously to specific churches, and then using their political influence, the Brotherhood facilitated placement of these 4 pieces in carefully chosen churches in Rome. Each piece, of course, was a marker, subtly pointing to the next church, where the next marker awaited. It functioned as a trail of clues disguised as religious art. If an Illuminati candidate could find the first church and the marker for earth, he could follow it to air, and then to fire, and then to water, and finally to the Church of Illumination." Vittoria was looking less and less clear. "And this has something to do with catching the Illuminati assassin?" Langdon smiled as he played his ace. "Oh, yes. The Illuminati called these four churches by a very special name. The Altars of Science. Victoria frowned.
I'm sorry, that means nothing.
She stopped short.
L'Altare di Scienza, she exclaimed.
The Illuminati assassin. He warned that the cardinals would be virgin sacrifices on the Altars of Science.
Langdon gave her a smile. Four cardinals, four churches, the four Altars of Science.
She looked stunned. You're saying the four churches where the cardinals will be sacrificed are the same four churches that mark the path of illumination?
I believe so, yes.
But why would the killer have given us that clue?
Why not? Langdon replied. Very few historians know about these sculptures. Even fewer believe they exist. And their locations have remained secret for 400 years. No doubt the Illuminati trusted the secret for another 5 hours. Besides, the Illuminati don't need their path of illumination anymore. Their secret lair is probably long gone anyway. They live in the modern world. They meet in bank boardrooms, eating clubs, private golf courses. Tonight they want to make their secrets public. This is their moment, their grand unveiling.
Langdon feared the Illuminati unveiling would have a special symmetry to it that he had not yet mentioned. The four brands. The killer is sworn each cardinal would be branded with a different symbol. Proof the ancient legends are true, the killer had said. The legend of the four ambigrammatic brands was as old as the Illuminati itself. Earth, air, fire, water. Four words crafted in perfect symmetry. Just like the word Illuminati. Each cardinal was to be branded with one of the ancient elements of science. The rumor that the four brands were in English rather than Italian remained a point of debate among historians. English seemed a random deviation from their natural tongue, and the Illuminati did nothing randomly. Langdon turned up the brick pathway before the archive building. Ghastly images thrashed in his mind. The overall Illuminati plot was starting to reveal its patient grandeur. The Brotherhood had vowed to stay silent as long as it took, amassing enough influence and power that they could resurface without fear, make their stand, fight their cause in broad daylight. The Illuminati were no longer about hiding. They were about flaunting their power, confirming the conspiratorial myths as fact. Tonight was a global publicity stunt.
Victoria said, "Here comes our escort."
Langdon looked up to see a Swiss guard hurrying across an adjacent lawn toward the front door. When the guard saw them, he stopped in his tracks. He stared at them, as though he thought he was hallucinating. Without a word, he turned away and pulled out his walkie-talkie. Apparently incredulous at what he was being asked to do, the guard spoke urgently to the person on the other end. The angry bark coming back was indecipherable to Langdon, but its message was clear. The guard slumped, put away the walkie-talkie, and turned to them with a look of discontent. Not a word was spoken as the guard guided them into the building. They passed through four steel doors, two passkey entries, down a long stairwell, and into a foyer with two combination keypads. Passing through a high-tech series of electronic gates, they arrived at the end of a long hallway outside a set of wide oak double doors. The guard stopped, looked them over again, and, mumbling under his breath, walked to a metal box on the wall. He unlocked it, reached inside, and pressed a code. The doors before them buzzed, and the deadbolt fell open. The guard turned, speaking to them for the first time. "The archives are beyond that door. I have been instructed to escort you this far and return for briefing on another matter."
"You're leaving?" Victoria demanded.
"Swiss guards are not cleared for access to the secret archives. You are here only because my commander received a direct order from the Camerlengo."
"But how do we get out?"
"Monodirectional security. You will have no difficulties." That being the entirety of the conversation, the guard spun on his heel and marched off down the hall. Victoria made some comment, but Langdon didn't hear. His mind was fixed on the double doors before him, wondering what mysteries lay beyond. Chapter 47. Although he knew time was short, Camerlengo Carlo Ventresca walked slowly. He needed the time alone to gather his thoughts before facing opening prayer. So much was happening. As he moved in dim solitude down the northern wing, the challenge of the past 15 days weighed heavy in his bones. He had followed his holy duties to the letter. As was Vatican tradition, following the Pope's death, the Camerlengo had personally confirmed expiration by placing his fingers on the Pope's carotid artery, listening for breath, and then calling the Pope's name 3 times. By law, there was no autopsy. Then he had sealed the Pope's bedroom, destroyed the papal fisherman's ring, shattered the die used to make lead seals, and arranged for the funeral. That done, he began preparations for the conclave. Conclave, he thought, the final hurdle. It was one of the oldest traditions in Christendom. Nowadays, because the outcome of conclave was usually known before it began, the process was criticized as obsolete, more of a burlesque than an election. The Camerlengo knew, however, this was only a lack of understanding. Conclave was not an election. It was an ancient, mystic transference of power. The tradition was timeless. The secrecy, the folded slips of paper, the burning of the ballots, the mixing of ancient chemicals, the smoke signals. As the Camerlengo approached through the loggias of Gregory XIII, he wondered if Cardinal Mortati was in a panic yet. Certainly Mortati had noticed the preferiti were missing. Without them, the voting would go on all night. Mortati's appointment as the great elector, the Camerlengo assured himself, was a good one. The man was a free thinker and could speak his mind. The conclave would need a leader tonight more than ever. As the Camerlengo arrived at the top of the royal staircase, he felt as though he were standing on the precipice of his life. Even from up here, he could hear the rumble of activity in the Sistine Chapel below, the uneasy chatter of 165 cardinals. 161 cardinals, he corrected. For an instant, the Camerlengo was falling, plummeting toward hell, people screaming, flames engulfing him, stones and blood raining from the sky. And then silence. When the child awoke, he was in heaven. Everything around him was white. The light was blinding and pure. Although some would say a 10-year-old could not possibly understand heaven, the young Carlo Ventresca understood heaven very well. He was in heaven right now. Where else could he be? Even in his short decade on earth, Carlo had felt the majesty of God. The thundering pipe organs, the towering domes, the voices raised in song, the stained glass, shimmering bronze and gold. Carlo's mother, Maria, brought him to Mass every day. The church was Carlo's home. "Why do we come to Mass every single day?" Carlo asked. Not that he minded at all. "Because I promised God I would," she replied. "And a promise to God is the most important promise of all. Never break a promise to God." Carlo promised her he would never break a promise to God. He loved his mother more than anything in the world. She was his holy angel. Sometimes he called her Maria Benedetta, the Blessed Mary, although she did not like that at all. He knelt with her as she prayed, smelling the sweet scent of her flesh and listening to the murmur of her voice as she counted the rosary. Hail Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. "Where is my father?" Carlo asked, already knowing his father had died before he was born. "God is your father now," she would always reply. "You are a child of the church." Carlo loved that. "Whenever you feel frightened," she said, "remember that God is your father now. He will watch over you and protect you forever. God has big plans for you, Carlo." The boy knew she was right. He could already feel God in his blood. Blood. Blood raining from the sky. Silence. Then heaven. His heaven, Carla learned as the blinding lights were turned off, was actually the intensive care unit in Santa Clara Hospital, outside of Palermo. Carlo had been the sole survivor of a terrorist bombing that had collapsed a chapel where he and his mother had been attending Mass while on vacation. 37 people had died, including Carlo's mother. The papers called Carlo's survival the miracle of St. Francis. Carlo had, for some unknown reason, only moments before the blast, left his mother's side and ventured into a protected alcove to ponder a tapestry depicting the story of St. Francis. "God called me there," he decided. "He wanted to save me." Carlo was delirious with pain. He could still see his mother kneeling at the pew, blowing him a kiss. And then, with a concussive roar, her sweet-smelling flesh was torn apart. He could still taste man's evil. Blood showered down. His mother's blood. The Blessed Maria. "God will watch over you and protect you forever," his mother had told him. But where was God now? Then, like a worldly manifestation of his mother's truth, a clergyman had come to the hospital. He was not any clergyman. He was a bishop. He prayed over Carlo, the miracle of St. Francis. When Carlo recovered, the bishop arranged for him to live in a small monastery attached to the cathedral over which the bishop presided. Carlo lived and tutored with the monks. He even became an altar boy for his new protector. The bishop suggested Carlo enter public school, but Carlo refused. He could not have been more happy with his new home. He now truly lived in the house of God. Every night, Carlo prayed for his mother. "God saved me for a reason," he thought. "What is the reason?" When Carlo turned 16, he was obliged by Italian law to serve 2 years of reserve military training. The bishop told Carlo that if he entered seminary, he would be exempt from this duty. Carlo told the priest that he planned to enter seminary, but that first he needed to understand evil. The bishop didn't understand. Carlo told him that if he was going to spend his life in the church fighting evil, first he had to understand it. He couldn't think of any better place to understand evil than in the army. The army used guns and bombs. A bomb killed my blessed mother. The bishop tried to dissuade him, but Carlo's mind was made up. "Be careful, my son," the bishop had said, "and remember, the church awaits you when you return." Carlo's 2 years of military service had been dreadful. Carlo's youth had been one of silence and reflection, but in the army there was no quiet for reflection. Endless noise, huge machines everywhere, not a moment of peace. Although the soldiers went to Mass once a week at the barracks, Carlo did not sense God's presence in any of his fellow soldiers. Their minds were too filled with chaos to see God. Carlo hated his new life and wanted to go home, but he was determined to stick it out. He had yet to understand evil. He refused to fire a gun, so the military taught him how to fly a medical helicopter. Carlo hated the noise and the smell, but at least it let him fly up in the sky and be closer to his mother in heaven. When he was informed his pilot's training included learning how to parachute, Carlo was terrified. Still, he had no choice. "God will protect me," he told himself. Carlo's first parachute jump was the most exhilarating physical experience of his life. It was like flying with God. Carlo could not get enough. The silence, the floating, seeing his mother's face in the billowing white clouds as he soared to earth. "God has plans for you, Carlo." When he returned from the military, Carlo entered the seminary. That had been 23 years ago. Now, as Camerlengo Carlo Ventresca descended the royal staircase, he tried to comprehend the chain of events that had delivered him to this extraordinary crossroads. "Abandon all fear," he told himself, "and give this night over to God." He could see the great bronze door of the Sistine Chapel now, dutifully protected by 4 Swiss guards. The guards unbolted the door and pulled it open. Inside, every head turned. The Camerlengo gazed out at the black robes and red sashes before him. He understood what God's plans for him were. The fate of the church had been placed in his hands. The Camerlengo crossed himself and stepped over the threshold. Chapter 48 BBC journalist Gunther Glick sat sweating in the BBC network van parked on the eastern edge of St. Peter's Square and cursed his assignment editor. Although Glick's first monthly review had come back filled with superlatives, resourceful, sharp, dependable, here he was in Vatican City on Pope Watch. He reminded himself that reporting for the BBC carried a hell of a lot more credibility than fabricating fodder for the British Tatler. But still, this was not his idea of reporting. Glick's assignment was simple, insultingly simple. He was to sit here waiting for a bunch of old farts to elect their next chief old fart. Then he was to step outside and record a 15-second live spot with the Vatican as a backdrop. Brilliant. Glick couldn't believe the BBC still sent reporters into the field to cover this schlock. You don't see the American networks here tonight. Hell no. That was because the big boys did it right. They watched CNN, synopsized it, and then filmed their live report in front of a blue screen, superimposing stock video for a realistic backdrop. MSNBC even used in-studio wind and rain machines to give that on-the-scene authenticity. Viewers didn't want truth anymore. They wanted entertainment. Glick gazed out through the windshield and felt more and more depressed by the minute. The imperial mountain of Vatican City rose before him as a dismal reminder of what men could accomplish when they put their minds to it. "What have I accomplished in my life?" he wondered aloud. "Nothing." "So, give up," a woman's voice said from behind him. Glick jumped. He had almost forgotten he wasn't alone. He turned to the back seat, where his camera woman, Shanita Macri, sat silently polishing her glasses. She was always polishing her glasses. Shanita was black, although she preferred African-American. A little heavy and smart as hell. She wouldn't let you forget it, either. She was an odd bird, but Glick liked her. And Glick could sure as hell use the company. "What's the problem, Gunth?" Shanita asked. "What are we doing here?" She kept polishing. "Witnessing an exciting event? Old men locked in the dark is exciting. You do know you're going to hell, don't you?"
"Already there."
"Talk to me." She sounded like his mother.
"I just feel like I want to leave my mark."
"You wrote for the British Tatler."
"Yeah, but nothing with any resonance."
"Oh, come on. I heard you did a groundbreaking article on the Queen's secret sex life with aliens."
"Thanks."
"Hey, things are looking up. Tonight you make your first 15 seconds of TV history." Glick groaned. He could hear the news anchor already. "Thanks, Gunther. Great report." Then the anchor would roll his eyes and move on to the weather. "I should have tried for an anchor spot." Macri laughed. "With no experience? And that beard? Forget it." Glick ran his hands through the reddish gob of hair on his chin.
"I think it makes me look clever."
The van's cell phone rang, mercifully interrupting yet another of Glick's failures.
"Maybe that's editorial," he said, suddenly hopeful. "You think they want a live update?"
"On this story?" Macri laughed. "You keep dreaming." Glick answered the phone in his best anchorman voice.
"Gunther Glick, BBC. Live in Vatican City."
The man on the line had a thick Arabic accent.
"Listen carefully," he said. "I am about to change your life."
Chapter 49 Langdon and Vittoria stood alone now outside the double doors that led to the inner sanctum of the secret archives. The decor in the colonnade was an incongruous mix of wall-to-wall carpets over marble floors, and wireless security cameras gazing down from beside carved cherubs in the ceiling. Langdon dubbed it Sterile Renaissance. Beside the arched ingress hung a small bronze plaque. Archivio Vaticano, Curatore Padre Jacqui Tommaso. Father Jacqui Tommaso. Langdon recognized the curator's name from the rejection letters at home in his desk. Dear Mr. Langdon, it is with regret that I am writing to deny... Regret. Bullshit. Since Jacqui Tommaso's reign had begun, Langdon had never met a single non-Catholic American scholar who had been given access to the secret Vatican archives.
Il Guardiano, historians called him.
Jacqui Tommaso was the toughest librarian on earth. As Langdon pushed the doors open and stepped through the vaulted portal into the inner sanctum, he half expected to see Father Jacqui in full military fatigues and helmet, standing guard with a bazooka. The space, however, was deserted. Silence. Soft lighting. Archivio Vaticano. One of his life dreams.
As Langdon's eyes took in the sacred chamber, his first reaction was one of embarrassment.
He realized what a callow romantic he was. The images he had held for so many years of this room could not have been more inaccurate. He had imagined dusty bookshelves piled high with tattered volumes, priests cataloging by the light of candles and stained-glass windows, monks poring over scrolls. Not even close. At first glance, the room appeared to be a darkened airline hangar in which someone had built a dozen freestanding racquetball courts. Langdon knew, of course, what the glass-walled enclosures were. He wasn't surprised to see them. Humidity and heat eroded ancient vellums and parchments, and proper preservation required hermetic vaults like these. Airtight cubicles that kept out humidity and natural acids in the air. Langdon had been inside hermetic vaults many times, but it was always an unsettling experience. Something about entering an airtight container, where the oxygen was regulated by a reference librarian. The vaults were dark, ghostly even, faintly outlined by tiny dome lights at the end of each stack. In the blackness of each cell, Langdon sensed the phantom giants, row upon row of towering stacks, laden with history. This was one hell of a collection. Vittoria also seemed dazzled. She stood beside him, staring mutely at the giant transparent cubes. Time was short, and Langdon wasted none of it scanning the dimly lit room for a book catalog, a bound encyclopedia that cataloged the library's collection. All he saw was the glow of a handful of computer terminals dotting the room. "Looks like they've got a biblion. Their index is computerized." Vittoria looked hopeful. "That should speed things up." Langdon wished he shared her enthusiasm, but he sensed this was bad news. He walked to a terminal and began typing. His fears were instantly confirmed. The old-fashioned method would have been better.
Why?
He stepped back from the monitor. Because real books don't have password protection. I don't suppose physicists are natural-born hackers. Vittoria shook her head. I can open oysters, that's about it. Langdon took a deep breath and turned to face the eerie collection of diaphanous vaults. He walked to the nearest one and squinted into the dim interior. Inside the glass were amorphous shapes Langdon recognized as the usual bookshelves, parchment bins, and examination tables. He looked up at the indicator tabs glowing at the end of each stack. As in all libraries, the tabs indicated the contents of that row. He read the headlines as he moved down the transparent barrier.
Pietro l'Eremita, Le Crociate, Urbano II, Levant.
They're labeled, he said, still walking, but it's not Alpha Author. He wasn't surprised. Ancient archives were almost never catalogued alphabetically because so many of the authors were unknown. Titles didn't work either, because many historical documents were untitled letters or parchment fragments. Most cataloging was done chronologically. Disconcertingly, however, this arrangement did not appear to be chronological. Langdon felt precious time already slipping away. Looks like the Vatican has its own system. What a surprise. He examined the labels again. The document spanned centuries, but all the key words, he realized, were interrelated. I think it's a thematic classification. Thematic? Vittoria said, sounding like a disapproving scientist. Sounds inefficient. Actually, Langdon thought, considering it more closely, this may be the shrewdest cataloging I've ever seen. He had always urged his students to understand the overall tones and motifs of an artistic period, rather than getting lost in the minutiae of dates and specific works. The Vatican archives, it seemed, were cataloged on a similar philosophy. Broad strokes. Everything in this vault, Langdon said, feeling more confident now. Centuries of material has to do with the Crusades. That's this vault's theme. It was all here, he realized. Historical accounts, letters, artwork, socio-political data, modern analyses, all in one place, encouraging a deeper understanding of a topic. Brilliant. Vittoria frowned. But data can relate to multiple themes simultaneously. Which is why they cross-reference with proxy markers. Langdon pointed through the glass to the colorful plastic tabs inserted among the documents. Those indicate secondary documents located elsewhere with their primary themes. Sure, she said, apparently letting it go. She put her hands on her hips and surveyed the enormous space. Then she looked at Langdon. So, Professor, what's the name of this Galileo thing we're looking for? Langdon couldn't help but smile. He still couldn't fathom that he was standing in this room. It's in here, he thought, somewhere in the dark. It's waiting. Follow me, Langdon said. He started briskly down the first aisle, examining the indicator tabs of each vault. Remember how I told you about the path of illumination? How the Illuminati recruited new members using an elaborate test? The treasure hunt, Vittoria said, following closely. The challenge the Illuminati had was that after they placed the markers, they needed some way to tell the scientific community the path existed. Logical, Vittoria said. Otherwise nobody would know to look for it. Yes. And even if they knew the path existed, scientists would have no way of knowing where the path began. Rome is huge. Okay. Langdon proceeded down the next aisle, scanning the tabs as he talked. About 15 years ago, some historians at the Sorbonne and I uncovered a series of Illuminati letters filled with references to the segno. The sign. The announcement about the path and where it began. Yes. And since then, plenty of Illuminati academics, myself included, have uncovered other references to the segno. It is accepted theory now that the clue exists, and that Galileo mass-distributed it to the scientific community without the Vatican ever knowing. How? We're not sure, but most likely printed publications. He published many books and newsletters over the years. That the Vatican no doubt saw sounds dangerous. True. Nonetheless, the segno was distributed. But nobody has ever actually found it? No. Oddly enough, wherever allusions to the segno appear, Masonic diaries, ancient scientific journals, Illuminati letters, it is often referred to by a number. 666? Langdon smiled. Actually, it's 503. Meaning? None of us could ever figure it out. I became fascinated with 503, trying everything to find meaning in the number. Numerology, map references, latitudes. Langdon reached the end of the aisle, turned the corner, and hurried to scan the next row of tabs as he spoke. For many years, the only clue seemed to be that 503 began with the number 5, one of the sacred Illuminati digits. He paused. Something tells me you recently figured it out, and that's why we're here. Correct, Langdon said, allowing himself a rare moment of pride in his work. Are you familiar with the book by Galileo called Dialogo? Of course. famous among scientists as the ultimate scientific sellout. Sellout wasn't quite the word Langdon would have used, but he knew what Vittoria meant. In the early 1630s, Galileo had wanted to publish a book endorsing the Copernican heliocentric model of the solar system. But the Vatican wouldn't permit the book's release unless Galileo included equally persuasive evidence for the Church's geocentric model, a model Galileo knew to be dead wrong. Galileo had no choice but to acquiesce to the Church's demands and publish a book giving equal time to both the accurate and inaccurate models. "As you probably know," Langdon said, "despite Galileo's compromise, Dialogo was seen as heretical, and the Vatican placed him under house arrest." "No good deed goes unpunished," Langdon smiled. "So true. And yet Galileo was persistent. While under house arrest, he secretly wrote a lesser-known manuscript that scholars often confuse with Dialogo. That book is called Discorsi." Vittoria nodded. "I've heard of it. Discourses on the Tides." Langdon stopped short, amazed she had heard of the obscure publication about planetary motion and its effect on the tides. "Hey," she said, "you're talking to an Italian marine physicist whose father worshipped Galileo." Langdon laughed. Discorsi, however, was not what they were looking for. Langdon explained that Discorsi had not been Galileo's only work while under house arrest. Historians believed he had also written an obscure booklet called Diagramma. "Diagramma della verità," Langdon said. "Diagram of truth." "Never heard of it." "I'm not surprised. Diagramma was Galileo's most secretive work. Supposedly some sort of treatise on scientific facts he held to be true but was not allowed to share. Like some of Galileo's previous manuscripts, Diagramma was smuggled out of Rome by a friend and quietly published in Holland. The booklet became wildly popular in the European scientific underground. Then the Vatican caught wind of it and went on a book-burning campaign." Vittoria now looked intrigued. "And you think Diagramma contained the clue, the segno, the information about the path of illumination?" "Diagramma is how Galileo got the word out. That I'm sure of." Langdon entered the third row of vaults and continued surveying the indicator tabs. "Archivists have been looking for a copy of Diagramma for years. But between the Vatican burnings and the booklet's low permanence rating, the booklet has disappeared off the face of the earth." "Permanence rating? Durability? Archivists rate documents 1 through 10 for their structural integrity. Diagramma was printed on sedge papyrus. It's like tissue paper. Lifespan of no more than a century." "Why not something stronger?" "Galileo's behest, to protect his followers. This way any scientists caught with a copy could simply drop it in water and the booklet would dissolve. It was great for destruction of evidence, but terrible for archivists. It is believed that only one copy of Diagramma survived beyond the 18th century." "One?" Vittoria looked momentarily starstruck as she glanced around the room. "And it's here?" "Confiscated from the Netherlands by the Vatican shortly after Galileo's death. I've been petitioning to see it for years now, ever since I realized what was in it." As if reading Langdon's mind, Vittoria moved across the aisle and began scanning the adjacent bay of vaults, doubling their pace. "Thanks," he said. "Look for reference tabs that have anything to do with Galileo, science, scientists. You'll know it when you see it." "Okay, but you still haven't told me how you figured out Diagramma contained the clue. It had something to do with the number you kept seeing in Illuminati letters. 503. Langdon smiled. "Yes, it took some time, but I finally figured out that 503 is a simple code. It clearly points to Diagramma." For an instant, Langdon relived his moment of unexpected revelation. August 16, 2 years ago, he was standing lakeside at the wedding of the son of a colleague. Bagpipes droned on the water as the wedding party made their unique entrance, across the lake on a barge. The craft was festooned with flowers and wreaths. It carried a Roman numeral painted proudly on the hull, DCII. Puzzled by the marking, Langdon asked the father of the bride, "What's with 602? 602? Langdon pointed at the barge. DCII is the Roman numeral for 602. The man laughed. "That's not a Roman numeral. That's the name of the barge." "The DCII?" The man nodded. "The Dick and Connie, too." Langdon felt sheepish. Dick and Connie were the wedding couple. The barge obviously had been named in their honor. "What happened to the DC-1? The man groaned. "It sank yesterday during the rehearsal luncheon." Langdon laughed. "Sorry to hear that." He looked back out at the barge. "The DC-2, he thought, like a miniature QE-2. A second later, it had hit him. Now Langdon turned to Vittoria. 503, he said, as I mentioned, is a code. It's an Illuminati trick for concealing what was actually intended as a Roman numeral. The number 503 in Roman numerals is D-I-I-I. Langdon glanced up. That was fast. Please don't tell me you're an Illuminata. She laughed. I use Roman numerals to codify pelagic strata. Of course, Langdon thought. Don't we all? Vittoria looked over. So what is the meaning of D-I-I-I? D-I and D-I-I and D-I-I-I are very old abbreviations. They were used by ancient scientists to distinguish between the three Galilean documents most commonly confused. Vittoria drew a quick breath. Dialogo, discorsi, diagramma? D-1, D-2, D-3. All scientific, all controversial. 503 is D-I-I-I. Diagramma, the third of his books. Vittoria looked troubled. But one thing still doesn't make sense. If this señor, this clue, this advertisement about the path of illumination was really in Galileo's diagramma, why didn't the Vatican see it when they repossessed all the copies? They may have seen it and not noticed. Remember the Illuminati markers? Hiding things in plain view? Dissimulation? The señor apparently was hidden the same way, in plain view, invisible to those who weren't looking for it, and also invisible to those who didn't understand it. Meaning? Meaning Galileo hid it well. According to historic record, the señor was revealed in a mode the Illuminati called lingua pura. The pure language? Yes. Mathematics? That's my guess. Seems pretty obvious. Galileo was a scientist, after all, and he was writing for scientists. Math would be a logical language in which to lay out the clue. The booklet is called Diagramma, so mathematical diagrams may also be part of the code. Vittoria sounded only slightly more hopeful. I suppose Galileo could have created some sort of mathematical code that went unnoticed by the clergy. You don't sound sold, Langdon said, moving down the row. I'm not. Mainly because you aren't. If you were so sure about D-I-I-I, why didn't you publish? Then someone who did have access to the Vatican archives could have come in here and checked out Diagramma a long time ago. I didn't want to publish, Langdon said. I had worked hard to find the information and... He stopped himself, embarrassed. You wanted the glory. Langdon felt himself flush. In a manner of speaking. It's just that... Don't look so embarrassed. You're talking to a scientist. Publish or perish. At CERN, we call it substantiate or suffocate. It wasn't only wanting to be the first. I was also concerned that if the wrong people found out about the information in Diagramma, it might disappear. The wrong people being the Vatican? Not that they were wrong, per se, but the Church has always downplayed the Illuminati threat. In the early 1900s, the Vatican went so far as to say the Illuminati were a figment of overactive imaginations. The clergy felt, and perhaps rightly so, that the last thing Christians needed to know was that there was a very powerful anti-Christian movement infiltrating their banks, politics, and universities. Present tense, Robert, he reminded himself. There is a powerful anti-Christian force infiltrating their banks, politics, and universities.
So you think the Vatican would have buried any evidence corroborating the Illuminati threat?
Quite possibly. Any threat, real or imagined, weakens faith in the Church's power.
One more question. Vittoria stopped short and looked at him like he was an alien. Are you serious?
Langdon stopped. What do you mean?
I mean, is this really your plan to save the day?
Langdon wasn't sure whether he saw amused pity or sheer terror in her eyes.
You mean finding the diagramma?
No, I mean finding diagramma, locating a 400-year-old senyo, deciphering some mathematical code, and following an ancient trail of art that only the most brilliant scientists in history have ever been able to follow, all in the next 4 hours.
Langdon shrugged. I'm open to other suggestions.
Chapter 50.
Robert Langdon stood outside Archive Vault 9 and read the labels on the stacks. Brahe, Clavius, Copernicus, Kepler, Newton. As he read the names again, he felt a sudden uneasiness. Here are the scientists, but where is Galileo? He turned to Vittoria, who was checking the contents of a nearby vault.
I found the right theme, but Galileo's missing.
No, he isn't, she said, frowning as she motioned to the next vault. He's over here. But I hope you brought your reading glasses, because this entire vault is his.
Langdon ran over. Vittoria was right. Every indicator tab in Vault 10 carried the same keyword. Il processo Galileano.
Langdon let out a low whistle, now realizing why Galileo had his own vault.
The Galileo affair, he marveled, peering through the glass at the dark outlines of the stacks. The longest and most expensive legal proceeding in Vatican history. 14 years and 600 million lira. It's all here.
Have a few legal documents.
I guess lawyers haven't involved much over the centuries.
Neither have sharks.
Langdon strode to a large yellow button on the side of the vault. He pressed it, and a bank of overhead lights hummed on inside. The lights were deep red, turning the cube into a glowing crimson cell, a maze of towering shelves.
My God, Vittoria said, looking spooked. Are we tanning or working?
Parchment and vellum fades, so vault lighting is always done with dark lights.
You could go mad in here.
Or worse, Langdon thought, moving toward the vault's sole entrance.
A quick word of warning. Oxygen is an oxidant, so hermetic vaults contain very little of it. It's a partial vacuum inside. Your breathing will feel strained.
Hey, if old cardinals can survive it.
True, Langdon thought. May we be as lucky.
The vault entrance was a single electronic revolving door. Langdon noted the common arrangement of 4 access buttons on the door's inner shaft, one accessible from each compartment. When a button was pressed, the motorized door would kick into gear and make the conventional half-rotation before grinding to a halt, a standard procedure to preserve the integrity of the inner atmosphere.
After I'm in, Langdon said, just press the button and follow me through. There's only 8% humidity inside, so be prepared to feel some dry mouth.
Langdon stepped into the rotating compartment and pressed the button. The door buzzed loudly and began to rotate. As he followed its motion, Langdon prepared his body for the physical shock that always accompanied the first few seconds in a hermetic vault. Entering a sealed archive was like going from sea level to 20,000 feet in an instant. Nausea and lightheadedness were not uncommon. Double vision, double over, he reminded himself, quoting the archivist mantra. Langdon felt his ears pop. There was a hiss of air, and the door spun to a stop. He was in. Langdon's first realization was that the air inside was thinner than he had anticipated. The Vatican, it seemed, took their archives a bit more seriously than most. Langdon fought the gag reflex and relaxed his chest while his pulmonary capillaries dilated. The tightness passed quickly. "Enter the dolphin," he mused. Gratified, his 50 laps a day were good for something. Breathing more normally now, he looked around the vault. Despite the transparent outer walls, he felt a familiar anxiety. "I'm in a box," he thought. "A blood-red box." The door buzzed behind him, and Langdon turned to watch Victoria enter. When she arrived inside, her eyes immediately began watering, and she started breathing heavily. "Give it a minute," Langdon said. "If you get light-headed, bend over."
"I feel," Victoria choked, "like I'm scuba diving with the wrong mixture."
Langdon waited for her to acclimatize. He knew she'd be fine. Victoria Vetra was obviously in terrific shape. Nothing like the doddering ancient Radcliffe alumni Langdon had once squired through Widener Library's hermetic vault. The tour had ended with Langdon giving mouth-to-mouth to an old woman who'd almost aspirated her false teeth. "Feeling better?" he asked. Victoria nodded. "I rode your damn space plane, so I thought I owed you." This brought a smile.
"Touché."
Langdon reached into the box beside the door and extracted some white cotton gloves. "Formal affair?" Victoria asked. "Finger acid. We can't handle the documents without them. You'll need a pair." Victoria donned some gloves.
"How long do we have?"
Langdon checked his Mickey Mouse watch.
"It's just past 7. We have to find this thing within the hour."
"Actually," Langdon said, "we don't have that kind of time." He pointed overhead to a filtered duct. Normally the curator would turn on a reoxygenation system when someone is inside the vault. Not today. 20 minutes, we'll both be sucking wind. Victoria blanched noticeably in the reddish glow. Langdon smiled and smoothed his gloves. "Substantiate or suffocate, Miss Vetra. Mickey's ticking." Chapter 51 BBC reporter Gunther Glick stared at the cell phone in his hand for 10 seconds before he finally hung up. Chinita Macri studied him from the back of the van.
"What happened? Who was that?"
Glick turned, feeling like a child who had just received a Christmas gift he feared was not really for him.
"I just got a tip. Something's going on inside the Vatican."
"It's called Conclave," Chinita said. "Hell of a tip."
"No, something else.
Something big." He wondered if the story the caller had just told him could possibly be true. Glick felt ashamed when he realized he was praying it was.
"What if I told you 4 cardinals have been kidnapped and are going to be murdered at different churches tonight?"
"I'd say you're being hazed by someone at the office with a sick sense of humor."
"What if I told you we were going to be given the exact location of the first murder?"
"I'd want to know who the hell you just talked to."
"He didn't say."
"Perhaps because he's full of shit?" Glick had come to expect Macri's cynicism. But what she was forgetting was that liars and lunatics had been Glick's business for almost a decade at the British Tatler. This caller had been neither. This man had been coldly sane. Logical.
"I will call you just before 8, the man had said, "and tell you where the first killing will occur. The images you record will make you famous."
When Glick had demanded why the caller was giving him this information, the answer had been as icy as the man's Mideastern accent.
"The media is the right arm of anarchy."
"He told me something else, too," Glick said.
"What? That Elvis Presley was just elected Pope?"
"Dial into the BBC database, will you?"
Glick's adrenaline was pumping now.
"I want to see what other stories we've run on these guys."
"What guys?"
"Indulge me."
Macri sighed and pulled up the connection to the BBC database.
"This'll take a minute."
Glick's mind was swimming.
"The caller was very intent to know if I had a cameraman,
videographer,
and if we could transmit live."
1.537 megahertz.
"What is this about?"
The database beeped.
"Okay, we're in. Who is it you're looking for?"
Glick gave her the keyword. Macri turned and stared.
"I sure as hell hope you're kidding."
Chapter 52. The internal organization of Archival Vault 10 was not as intuitive as Langdon had hoped, and the Diagramma manuscript did not appear to be located with other similar Galilean publications. Without access to the computerized Biblion and a reference locator, Langdon and Vittoria were stuck.
"You're sure the Diagramma is in here?" Vittoria asked.
"Positive. It's a confirmed listing in both the Ufficio della Propaganda delle Fede..."
"Fine, as long as you're sure."
She headed left while he went right. Langdon began his manual search. He needed every bit of self-restraint not to stop and read every treasure he passed. The collection was staggering. The Assayer, the Starry Messenger, the Sunspot letters, Letter to the Grand Duchess Christina, Apologia pro Galileo, on and on. It was Vittoria who finally struck gold near the back of the vault. Her throaty voice called out,
"Diagramma della Verita."
Langdon dashed through the crimson haze to join her.
"Where?"
Vittoria pointed, and Langdon immediately realized why they had not found it earlier. The manuscript was in a folio bin, not on the shelves. Folio bins were a common means of storing unbound pages. The label on the front of the container left no doubt about the contents. Diagramma della Verita, Galileo Galilei, 1639. Langdon dropped to his knees, his heart pounding.
"Diagramma!"
He gave her a grin.
"Nice work. Help me pull out this bin."
Vittoria knelt beside him, and they heaved. The metal tray on which the bin was sitting rolled toward them on casters, revealing the top of the container.
"No lock?"
Vittoria said, sounding surprised at the simple latch.
"Never. Documents sometimes need to be evacuated quickly. Floods and fires." "So open it."
Langdon didn't need any encouragement. With his academic life's dream right in front of him, and the thinning air in the chamber, he was in no mood to dawdle. He unsnapped the latch and lifted the lid. Inside, flat on the floor of the bin, lay a black duck-cloth pouch. The cloth's breathability was critical to the preservation of its contents. Reaching in with both hands and keeping the pouch horizontal, Langdon lifted it out of the bin.
"I expected a treasure chest," Vittoria said. "Looks more like a pillowcase."
"Follow me," he said. Holding the bag before him like a sacred offering, Langdon walked to the center of the vault where he found the customary glass-topped archival exam table. Although the central location was intended to minimize in-vault travel of documents, researchers appreciated the privacy the surrounding stacks afforded. Career-making discoveries were uncovered in the top vaults of the world, and most academics didn't like rivals peering through the glass as they worked. Langdon laid the pouch on the table and unbuttoned the opening. Vittoria stood by. Rummaging through a tray of archivist tools, Langdon found the felt-pad pincers archivists called finger symbols, oversized tweezers with flattened discs on each arm. As his excitement mounted, Langdon feared at any moment he might awake back in Cambridge with a pile of test papers to grade. Inhaling deeply, he opened the bag. Fingers trembling in their cotton gloves, he reached in with his tongs.
"Relax," Vittoria said. "It's paper, not plutonium."
Langdon slid the tongs around the stack of documents inside and was careful to apply even pressure. Then, rather than pulling out the documents, he held them in place while he slid off the bag, an archivist's procedure for minimizing torque on the artifact. Not until the bag was removed and Langdon had turned on the exam dark light beneath the table did he begin breathing again. Vittoria looked like a specter now, lit from below by the lamp beneath the glass.
"Small sheets," she said, her voice reverent.
Langdon nodded. The stack of folios before them looked like loose pages from a small paperback novel. Langdon could see that the top sheet was an ornate pen and ink cover sheet, with the title, the date, and Galileo's name in his own hand. In that instant, Langdon forgot the cramped quarters, forgot his exhaustion, forgot the horrifying situation that had brought him here. He simply stared in wonder. Close encounters with history always left Langdon numbed with reverence, like seeing the brushstrokes on the Mona Lisa. The muted yellow papyrus left no doubt in Langdon's mind as to its age and authenticity. But excluding the inevitable fading, the document was in superb condition. Slight bleaching of the pigment, minor sundering and cohesion of the papyrus, but all in all in damn fine condition. He studied the ornate hand-etching of the cover, his vision blurred by the lack of humidity. Vittoria was silent. "Hand me a spatula, please." Langdon motioned beside Vittoria to a tray filled with stainless steel archival tools. She handed it to him. Langdon took the tool in his hand. It was a good one. He ran his fingers across the face to remove any static charge, and then, ever so carefully, slid the blade beneath the cover. Then, lifting the spatula, he turned over the cover sheet. The first page was written in longhand, the tiny, stylized calligraphy almost impossible to read. Langdon immediately noticed that there were no diagrams or numbers on the page. It was an essay. "Heliocentricity," Vittoria said, translating the heading on Folio 1. She scanned the text. "Looks like Galileo renouncing the geocentric model once and for all. Ancient Italian, though, so no promises on the translation." "Forget it," Langdon said. "We're looking for math, the pure language." He used the spatula tool to flip the next page. Another essay. No math or diagrams. Langdon's hands began to sweat inside his gloves. "Movement of the planets," Vittoria said, translating the title. Langdon frowned. On any other day, he would have been fascinated to read it. Incredibly, NASA's current model of planetary orbits, observed through high-powered telescopes, was supposedly almost identical to Galileo's original predictions. "No math," Vittoria said. "He's talking about retrograde motions and elliptical orbits or something." Elliptical orbits? Langdon recalled that much of Galileo's legal trouble had begun when he described planetary motion as elliptical. The Vatican exalted the perfection of the circle and insisted heavenly motion must be only circular. Galileo's Illuminati, however, saw perfection in the ellipse as well, revering the mathematical duality of its twin foci. The Illuminati's ellipse was prominent even today in modern Masonic tracing boards and footing inlays. "Next," Vittoria said. Langdon flipped. "Lunar phases and tidal motion," she said. "No numbers, no diagrams." Langdon flipped again. Nothing. He kept flipping through a dozen or so pages. Nothing, nothing, nothing. "I thought this guy was a mathematician," Vittoria said. "This is all text." Langdon felt the air in his lungs begin to thin. His hopes were thinning, too. The pile was waning. "Nothing here," Vittoria said. "No math. A few dates, a few standard figures, but nothing that looks like it could be a clue." Langdon flipped over the last folio and sighed. It, too, was an essay. "Short book," Vittoria said, frowning. Langdon nodded. "Merda, as we say in Rome." "Shit is right," Langdon thought. His reflection in the glass seemed mocking, like the image staring back at him this morning from his bay window, an aging ghost. "There's got to be something," he said, the hoarse desperation in his voice surprising him. "The Senyo is here somewhere. I know it." "Maybe you were wrong about D.I.I.I. Langdon turned and stared at her. "Okay," she agreed. "D.I.I.I. makes perfect sense, but maybe the clue isn't mathematical." "Lingua pura. What else would it be?" "Art?" "Except there are no diagrams or pictures on the book." "All I know is that lingua pura refers to something other than Italian. Math just seems logical." "I agree." Langdon refused to accept defeat so quickly. "The numbers must be written longhand. The math must be in words rather than equations. It'll take some time to read all the pages." "Time's something we don't have. We'll have to split the work." Langdon flipped the stack back over to the beginning. "I know enough Italian to spot numbers.
Using his spatula, he cut the stack like a deck of cards and laid the first half-dozen pages in front of Vittoria. "It's in here somewhere, I'm sure." Vittoria reached out and flipped her first page by hand. "Spatula," Langdon said, grabbing her an extra tool from the tray. "Use the spatula." "I'm wearing gloves," she grumbled. "How much damage could I cause?" "Just use it." Vittoria picked up the spatula. "You feeling what I'm feeling? Tense? No, short of breath." Langdon was definitely starting to feel it, too. The air was thinning faster than he had imagined. He knew they had to hurry. Archival conundrums were nothing new for him, but usually he had more than a few minutes to work them out. Without another word, Langdon bowed his head and began translating the first page in his stack. "Show yourself, damn it! Show yourself!" Chapter 53. Somewhere beneath Rome, the dark figure prowled down a stone ramp into the underground tunnel. The ancient passageway was lit only by torches, making the air hot and thick. Up ahead, the frightened voices of grown men called out in vain, echoing in the cramped spaces. As he rounded the corner, he saw them, exactly as he had left them. Four old men, terrified, sealed behind rusted iron bars in a stone cubicle. "Qui êtes-vous?" one of the men demanded in French. "What do you want with us?" "Hilfe," another said in German. "Let us go." "Are you aware who we are?" one asked in English, his accent Spanish.
"Silence,"
the raspy voice commanded. There was a finality about the word. The fourth prisoner, an Italian, quiet and thoughtful, looked into the inky void of his captor's eyes and swore he saw hell itself. "God help us," he thought. The killer checked his watch and then returned his gaze to the prisoners.
"Now then," he said, "who will be first?"
Chapter 54. Inside Archive Vault 10, Robert Langdon recited Italian numbers as he scanned the calligraphy before him.
"Mille, centi, uno, due, tre, cinquanta."
I need a numerical reference. Anything, damn it. When he reached the end of his current folio, he lifted the spatula to flip the page. As he aligned the blade with the next page, he fumbled, having difficulty holding the tool steady. Minutes later, he looked down and realized he had abandoned his spatula and was turning pages by hand. "Oops," he thought, feeling vaguely criminal. The lack of oxygen was affecting his inhibitions. "Looks like I'll burn in archivist's hell." "About damn time," Vittoria choked when she saw Langdon turning pages by hand. She dropped her spatula and followed suit.
"Any luck?"
Vittoria shook her head. "Nothing that looks purely mathematical. I'm skimming, but none of this reads like a clue." Langdon continued translating his folios with increasing difficulty. His Italian skills were rocky at best, and the tiny penmanship and archaic language was making it slow going. Vittoria reached the end of her stack before Langdon and looked disheartened as she flipped the pages back over. She hunkered down for another, more intense inspection. When Langdon finished his final page, he cursed under his breath and looked over at Vittoria. She was scowling, squinting at something on one of her folios.
"What is it?"
he asked. Vittoria didn't look up. "Did you have any footnotes on your pages?"
"Not that I noticed. Why?"
"This page has a footnote. It's obscured in a crease." Langdon tried to see what she was looking at, but all they could make out was the page number in the upper right-hand corner of the sheet. Folio 5. It took a moment for the coincidence to register. And even when it did, the connection seemed vague. Folio 5. 5. Pythagoras. Pentagrams. Illuminati. Langdon wondered if the Illuminati would have chosen page 5 on which to hide their clue. Through the reddish fog surrounding them, Langdon sensed a tiny ray of hope. "Is the footnote mathematical?" Vittoria shook her head. Text. One line. Very small printing. Almost illegible. His hopes faded. It's supposed to be math. Lingua pura. Yeah, I know, she hesitated. I think you'll want to hear this, though. Langdon sensed excitement in her voice. Go ahead. Squinting at the folio, Vittoria read the line. The path of light is laid, the sacred test. The words were nothing like what Langdon had imagined. I'm sorry? Vittoria repeated the line. The path of light is laid, the sacred test. Path of light? Langdon felt his posture straightening. That's what it says, path of light. As the words sank in, Langdon felt his delirium pierced by an instant of clarity. The path of light is laid, the sacred test. He had no idea how it helped them, but the line was as direct a reference to the path of illumination as he could imagine. Path of light, sacred test. His head felt like an engine revving on bad fuel. Are you sure of the translation? Vittoria hesitated. Actually, she glanced over at him with a strange look. It's not technically a translation. The line is written in English. For an instant, Langdon thought the acoustics in the chamber had affected his hearing. English? Vittoria pushed the document over to him, and Langdon read the minuscule printing at the bottom of the page. The path of light is laid, the sacred test. English? What is English doing in an Italian book? Vittoria shrugged. She, too, was looking tipsy. Maybe English is what they meant by the lingua pura. It's considered the international language of science. It's all we speak at CERN. But this was in the 1600s, Langdon argued. Nobody spoke English in Italy, not even... He stopped short, realizing what he was about to say. Not even the clergy. Langdon's academic mind hummed in high gear. In the 1600s, he said, talking faster now, English was one language the Vatican had not yet embraced. They dealt in Italian, Latin, German, even Spanish and French, but English was totally foreign inside the Vatican. They considered English a polluted free-thinker's language for profane men like Chaucer and Shakespeare. Langdon flashed suddenly on the Illuminati brands of earth, air, fire, and water. The legends that the brands were in English now made a bizarre kind of sense. So you're saying maybe Galileo considered English la lingua pura because it was the one language the Vatican did not control? Yes. Or maybe by putting the clue in English, Galileo was subtly restricting the readership away from the Vatican. But it's not even a clue, Vittoria argued. The path of light is laid, the sacred test. What the hell does that mean? She's right, thought Langdon. The line didn't help in any way. But as he spoke the phrase again in his mind, a strange fact hit him. Now that's odd, he thought. What are the chances of that? We need to get out of here, Vittoria said, sounding hoarse. Langdon wasn't listening. The path of light is laid, the sacred test. It's a damn line of iambic pentameter, he said suddenly, counting the syllables again. Five couplets of alternating stressed and unstressed syllables. Vittoria looked lost. Iambic who? For an instant, Langdon was back at Phillips Exeter Academy, sitting in a Sunday morning English class. Hell on earth. The school baseball star, Peter Greer, was having trouble remembering the number of couplets necessary for a line of Shakespearean iambic pentameter. Their professor, an animated schoolmaster named Bissell, leapt onto the table and bellowed, "Pentameter, Greer. Think of home plate, a pentagon, five sides, penta, 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 sheesh." Five couplets, Langdon thought. Each couplet, by definition, having two syllables. He could not believe in his entire career he had never made the connection. Iambic pentameter was a symmetrical meter based on the sacred Illuminati numbers of five and two. You're reaching, Langdon told himself, trying to push it from his mind. A meaningless coincidence. But the thought stuck. Five, for Pythagoras and the pentagram. 2 for the duality of all things. A moment later, another realization sent a numbing sensation down his legs. Iambic pentameter, on account of its simplicity, was often called pure verse or pure meter. La lingua pura? Could this have been the pure language the Illuminati had been referring to? The path of light is laid, the sacred test. Uh-oh, Vittoria said. Langdon wheeled to see her rotating the folio upside down. He felt a knot in his gut. Not again. There's no way that line is an ambigram. No, it's not an ambigram, but it's... She kept turning the document, 90 degrees at every turn. It's what? Vittoria looked up. It's not the only line. There's another? There's a different line on every margin. Top, bottom, left, and right. I think it's a poem. 4 lines? Langdon bristled with excitement. Galileo was a poet? Let me see. Vittoria didn't relinquish the page. She kept turning the page in quarter turns. I didn't see the lines before because they're on the edges. She cocked her head over the last line. Huh, you know what? Galileo didn't even write this. What? The poem is signed John Milton. John Milton? The influential English poet who wrote Paradise Lost was a contemporary of Galileo's, and a savant who conspiracy buffs put at the top of their list of Illuminati suspects. Milton's alleged affiliation with Galileo's Illuminati was one legend Langdon suspected was true. Not only had Milton made a well-documented 1638 pilgrimage to Rome to commune with enlightened men, but he had held meetings with Galileo during the scientist's house arrest, meetings portrayed in many Renaissance paintings, including Annibale Gatti's famous Galileo and Milton, which hung even now in the IMSS Museum in Florence. Milton knew Galileo, didn't he? Vittoria said, finally pushing the folio over to Langdon. Maybe he wrote the poem as a favor. Langdon clenched his teeth as he took the sheath document. Leaving it flat on the table, he read the line at the top. Then he rotated the page 90 degrees, reading the line in the right margin. Another twist, and he read the bottom. Another twist, the left. A final twist completed the circle. There were 4 lines in all. The first line Vittoria had found was actually the 3rd line of the poem. Utterly agape, he read the 4 lines again, clockwise in sequence, top, right, bottom, left. When he was done, he exhaled. There was no doubt in his mind. You found it, Miss Vetra. She smiled tightly. Good. Now can we get the hell out of here? I have to copy these lines down. I need to find a pencil and paper. Vittoria shook her head. Forget it, Professor. No time to play scribe. Mickey's ticking. She took the page from him and headed for the door. Langdon stood up. You can't take that outside. It's a... But Vittoria was already gone. Chapter 55. Langdon and Vittoria exploded onto the courtyard outside the secret archives. The fresh air felt like a drug as it flowed into Langdon's lungs. The purple spots in his vision quickly faded. The guilt, however, did not. He had just been accomplice to stealing a priceless relic from the world's most private vault. The Camerlengo had said, "I am giving you my trust." "Hurry," Vittoria said, still holding the folio in her hand and striding at a half-jog across Via Borgia in the direction of Olivetti's office. "If any water gets on that papyrus... Calm down. When we decipher this thing, we can return their sacred folio 5. Langdon accelerated to keep up. Beyond feeling like a criminal, he was still dazed over the document's spellbinding implications. John Milton was an Illuminatus. He composed the poem for Galileo to publish in Folio 5, far from the eyes of the Vatican. As they left the courtyard, Vittoria held out the folio for Langdon. "You think you can decipher this thing?" Or did we just kill all those brain cells for kicks?
Langdon took the document carefully in his hands. Without hesitation, he slipped it into one of the breast pockets of his tweed jacket, out of the sunlight and dangers of moisture.
I deciphered it already.
Vittoria stopped short.
You what?
Langdon kept moving. Vittoria hustled to catch up.
You read it once. I thought it was supposed to be hard.
Langdon knew she was right, and yet he had deciphered the Senyo in a single reading. A perfect stanza of iambic pentameter, and the first altar of science had revealed itself in pristine clarity. Admittedly, the ease with which he had accomplished the task left him with a nagging disquietude. He was a child of a Puritan work ethic. He could still hear his father speaking the old New England aphorism, "If it wasn't painfully difficult, you did it wrong." Langdon hoped the saying was false.
"I deciphered it," he said, moving faster now. "I know where the first killing is going to happen. We need to warn Olivetti."
Vittoria closed in on him.
"How could you already know? Let me see that thing again."
With the sleight of a boxer, she slipped a lissome hand into his pocket and pulled out the folio again.
"Careful," Langdon said. "You can't..."
Vittoria ignored him. Folio in hand, she floated beside him, holding the document up to the evening light, examining the margins. As she began reading aloud, Langdon moved to retrieve the folio, but instead found himself bewitched by Vittoria's alto, speaking the syllables in perfect rhythm with her gait. For a moment, hearing the verse aloud, Langdon felt transported in time, as though he were one of Galileo's contemporaries, listening to the poem for the first time, knowing it was a test, a map, a clue unveiling the four altars of science, the four markers that blazed a secret path across Rome. The verse flowed from Vittoria's lips like a song. "From Santi's earthly tomb with demons whole, cross Rome the mystic elements unfold. The path of light is laid, the sacred test. Let angels guide you on your lofty quest." Vittoria read it twice and then fell silent, as if letting the ancient words resonate on their own. "From Santi's earthly tomb," Langdon repeated in his mind. The poem was crystal clear about that. The path of illumination began at Santi's tomb. From there, across Rome, the markers blazed the trail. "From Santi's earthly tomb, with demons whole, cross Rome, the mystic elements unfold."
Mystic elements. Also clear. Earth, air, fire, water. Elements of science. The four Illuminati markers disguised as religious sculpture. "The first marker," Vittoria said, "sounds like it's at Santi's tomb."
Langdon smiled.
"I told you it wasn't that tough." "So who is Santi?" she asked, sounding suddenly excited. "And where's his tomb?"
Langdon chuckled to himself. He was amazed how few people knew Santi, the last name of one of the most famous Renaissance artists ever to live. His first name was world-renowned, the child prodigy who at the age of 25 was already doing commissions for Pope Julius II. And when he died, at only 38, left behind the greatest collection of frescoes the world had ever seen. Santi was a behemoth in the art world, and being known solely by one's first name was a level of fame achieved only by a few elite people. People like Napoleon, Galileo, and Jesus. And, of course, the demigods Langdon now heard blaring from Harvard dormitories. Sting, Madonna, Jewel, and the artist formerly known as Prince, who had changed his name to a symbol, causing Langdon to dub him the Tau Cross with intersecting hermaphroditic Ankh.
"Santi," Langdon said, "is the last name of the great Renaissance master, Raphael."
Vittoria looked surprised.
"Raphael? As in the Raphael?"
"The one and only." Langdon pushed on toward the office of the Swiss Guard.
"So the path starts at Raphael's tomb?"
"It actually makes perfect sense," Langdon said as they rushed on. "The Illuminati often considered great artists and sculptors honorary brothers in enlightenment.
the Illuminati could have chosen Raphael's tomb as a kind of tribute.
Langdon also knew that Raphael, like many other religious artists, was a suspected closet atheist. Vittoria slipped the folio carefully back in Langdon's pocket.
So where is he buried?
Langdon took a deep breath. Believe it or not, Raphael's buried in the Pantheon. Vittoria looked skeptical.
The Pantheon?
The Raphael at the Pantheon. Langdon had to admit the Pantheon was not what he had expected for the place meant for the first marker. He would have guessed the first altar of science to be some quiet, out-of-the-way church, something subtle. Even in the 1600s, the Pantheon, with its tremendous holed dome, was one of the best-known sites in Rome.
"Is the Pantheon even a church?" Vittoria asked.
"Oldest Catholic church in Rome."
Vittoria shook her head. "But do you really think the first cardinal could be killed at the Pantheon? That's got to be one of the busiest tourist spots in Rome."
Langdon shrugged. The Illuminati said they wanted the whole world watching. Killing a cardinal at the Pantheon would certainly open some eyes.
But how does this guy expect to kill someone at the Pantheon and get away unnoticed? It would be impossible.
As impossible as kidnapping four cardinals from Vatican City? The poem is precise.
And you're certain Raphael is buried inside the Pantheon?
I've seen his tomb many times. Vittoria nodded, still looking troubled.
What time is it?
Langdon checked.
7:30. Is the Pantheon far?
A mile, maybe. We've got time.
The poem said Santi's earthly tomb. Does that mean anything to you?
Langdon hastened diagonally across the courtyard of the Sentinel.
Earthly?
Actually, there's probably no more earthly place in Rome than the Pantheon. It got its name from the original religion practiced there, pantheism, the worship of all gods, specifically the pagan gods of Mother Earth. As a student of architecture, Langdon had been amazed to learn that the dimensions of the Pantheon's main chamber were a tribute to Gaia, the goddess of the earth. The proportions were so exact that a giant spherical globe could fit perfectly inside the building with less than a millimeter to spare.
Okay, Vittoria said, sounding more convinced. And Demon's Hole, from Santi's earthly tomb with Demon's Hole.
Langdon was not quite as sure about this.
Demon's Hole must mean the oculus, he said, making a logical guess. The famous circular opening in the Pantheon's roof. But it's a church, Vittoria said, moving effortlessly beside him. Why would they call the opening a Demon's Hole?
Langdon had actually been wondering that himself. He had never heard the term Demon's Hole, but he did recall a famous 6th-century critique of the Pantheon whose words seemed oddly appropriate now. The venerable Bede had once written that the hole in the Pantheon roof had been bored by demons trying to escape the building when it was consecrated by Boniface IV.
And why, Vittoria added as they entered a smaller courtyard, why would the Illuminati use the name Santi if he was really known as Raphael?
You ask a lot of questions.
My dad used to say that.
Two possible reasons. One, the word Raphael has too many syllables. It would have destroyed the poem's iambic pentameter.
Sounds like a stretch.
Langdon agreed. Okay, then maybe using Santi was to make the clue more obscure, so only very enlightened men would recognize the reference to Raphael. Vittoria didn't appear to buy this either.
I'm sure Raphael's last name was very well known when he was alive.
Surprisingly not. Single-name recognition was a status symbol. Raphael shunned his last name, much like pop stars do today. Take Madonna, for example. She never uses her surname Ciccone. Vittoria looked amused.
You know Madonna's last name?
Langdon regretted the example. It was amazing the kind of garbage a mind picked up living with 10,000 adolescents. As he and Vittoria passed the final gate toward the office of the Swiss Guard, their progress was halted without warning.
Para! A voice bellowed behind them.
Langdon and Vittoria wheeled to find themselves looking into the barrel of a rifle.
Attento! Vittoria exclaimed, jumping back. Watch it with...
Non sportarti,
the guard snapped, cocking the weapon.
Soldato!
A voice commanded from across the courtyard. Olivetti was emerging from the security center.
Let them go.
The guard looked bewildered.
Ma signore, è una donna.
Inside,
he yelled at the guard.
Signore, non posso.
Now, you have new orders.
Captain Rocher will be briefing the Corps in 2 minutes. We will be organizing a search.
Looking bewildered, the guard hurried into the security center. Olivetti marched toward Langdon, rigid and steaming.
Our most secret archives. I want an explanation.
We have good news, Langdon said.
Olivetti's eyes narrowed.
It better be damn good.
Chapter 56. The four unmarked Alfa Romeo 155 T-Sparks roared down Via dei Coronari like fighter jets off a runway. The vehicles carried 12 plain-clothed Swiss guards armed with Pardini semi-automatics, local-radius nerve gas canisters, and long-range stun guns. The three sharpshooters carried laser-sighted rifles. Sitting in the passenger seat of the lead car, Olivetti turned backward toward Langdon and Vittoria. His eyes were filled with rage.
You assured me a sound explanation, and this is what I get.
Langdon felt cramped in the small car.
I understand your...
No, you don't understand.
Olivetti never raised his voice, but his intensity tripled.
I have just removed a dozen of my best men from Vatican City on the eve of conclave. And I have done this to stake out the Pantheon based on the testimony of some American I have never met who has just interpreted a 400-year-old poem. I have also just left the search for this antimatter weapon in the hands of secondary officers.
Langdon resisted the urge to pull Folio 5 from his pocket and wave it in Olivetti's face.
All I know is that the information we found refers to Raphael's tomb, and Raphael's tomb is inside the Pantheon.
The officer behind the wheel nodded.
He's right, Commander. My wife and I...
Drive!
Olivetti snapped. He turned back to Langdon.
How could a killer accomplish an assassination in such a crowded place and escape unseen?
I don't know,
Langdon said. But the Illuminati are obviously highly resourceful. They've broken into both CERN and Vatican City. It's only by luck that we know where the first kill zone is.
The Pantheon is your one chance to catch this guy.
More contradictions,
Olivetti said.
One chance? I thought you said there was some sort of pathway, a series of markers. If the Pantheon is the right spot, we can follow the pathway to the other markers. We will have 4 chances to catch this guy.
I had hoped so, Langdon said, and we would have a century ago.
Langdon's realization that the Pantheon was the first altar of science had been a bittersweet moment. History had a way of playing cruel tricks on those who chased it. It was a long shot that the path of illumination would be intact after all of these years, with all of its statues in place. But part of Langdon had fantasized about following the path all the way to the end and coming face to face with the sacred Illuminati lair. Alas, he realized it was not to be. The Vatican had all the statues in the Pantheon removed and destroyed in the late 1800s. Vittoria looked shocked.
Why?
The statues were pagan Olympian gods. Unfortunately, that means the first marker is gone, and with it...
Any hope, Vittoria said, of finding the path of illumination and additional markers?
Langdon shook his head.
We have one shot. The Pantheon. After that, the path disappears.
Olivetti stared at them both a long moment, and then turned and faced front.
Pull over,
he barked at the driver. The driver swerved the car toward the curb and put on the brakes. 3 other Alfa Romeos skidded in behind them. The Swiss Guard convoy screeched to a halt.
What are you doing?
Vittoria demanded.
My job,
Olivetti said, turning in his seat, his voice like stone.
Mr. Langdon, when you told me you would explain the situation en route, I assumed I would be approaching the Pantheon with a clear idea of why my men are here. That is not the case. Because I am abandoning critical duties by being here, and because I have found very little that makes sense in this theory of yours about virgin sacrifices and ancient poetry, I cannot in good conscience continue. I am recalling this mission immediately.
He pulled out his walkie-talkie and clicked it on. Vittoria reached across the seat and grabbed his arm.
You can't!
Olivetti slammed down the walkie-talkie and fixed her with a red-hot stare.
Have you been to the Pantheon, Miss Vetra?
No, but I...
Let me tell you something about it. The Pantheon is a single room, a circular cell made of stone and cement. It has one entrance, no windows, one narrow entrance. That entrance is flanked at all times by no less than 4 armed Roman policemen who protect this shrine from art defacers, anti-Christian terrorists, and gypsy tourist scams.
Your point?
She said coolly.
My point, Olivetti's knuckles gripped the seat, my point is that what you have just told me is going to happen is utterly impossible. Can you give me one plausible scenario of how someone could kill a cardinal inside the Pantheon? How does one even get a hostage past the guards into the Pantheon in the first place? Much less actually kill him and get away.
Olivetti leaned over the seat, his coffee breath now in Langdon's face.
How, Mr. Langdon? One plausible scenario.
Langdon felt the tiny car shrink around him.
I have no idea. I'm not an assassin. I don't know how he'll do it. I only know...
One scenario?
Vittoria quipped, her voice unruffled.
How about this? The killer flies over in a helicopter and drops a screaming, branded cardinal down through the hole in the roof. The cardinal hits the marble floor and dies.
Everyone in the car turned and stared at Vittoria. Langdon didn't know what to think. You've got one sick imagination, lady, but you are quick.
Olivetti frowned. Possible, I admit, but hardly.
Or the killer drugs the cardinal, Vittoria said. Brings him to the Pantheon in a wheelchair like some old tourist. He wheels him inside, quietly slits his throat, and then walks out.
This seemed to wake up Olivetti a bit. Not bad, Langdon thought.
Or, she said, the killer could...
I heard you, Olivetti said. Enough.
He took a deep breath and blew it out. Someone rapped sharply on the window, and everyone jumped. It was a soldier from one of the other cars. Olivetti rolled down the window.
Everything all right, Commander?
The soldier was dressed in street clothes. He pulled back the sleeve of his denim shirt to reveal a black chronograph military watch.
7:40, Commander. We'll need time to get in position.
Olivetti nodded vaguely, but said nothing for many moments. He ran a finger back and forth across the dash, making a line in the dust. He studied Langdon in the side-view mirror, and Langdon felt himself being measured and weighed. Finally, Olivetti turned back to the guard. There was reluctance in his voice.
I'll want separate approaches. Cars to Piazza della Rotunda, Via degli Orfani, Piazza Sant'Ignacio, and Santa Eustachio. No closer than 2 blocks. Once you're parked, gear up and await my orders. 3 minutes.
Very good, sir.
The soldier returned to his car. Langdon gave Vittoria an impressed nod. She smiled back, and for an instant Langdon felt an unexpected connection, a thread of magnetism between them. The commander turned in his seat and locked eyes with Langdon.
Mr. Langdon, this had better not blow up in our faces.
Langdon smiled uneasily.
How could it?
Chapter 57. The director of CERN, Maximilian Kohler, opened his eyes to the cool rush of cromolyn and leukotriene in his body, dilating his bronchial tubes and pulmonary capillaries. He was breathing normally again. He found himself lying in a private room in the CERN infirmary, his wheelchair beside the bed. He took stock, examining the paper robe they had put him in. His clothing was folded on the chair beside the bed. Outside, he could hear the nurse making the rounds. He lay there a long minute listening.
Then, as quietly as possible, he pulled himself to the edge of the bed and retrieved his clothing. Struggling with his dead legs, he dressed himself. Then he dragged his body onto his wheelchair. Muffling a cough, he wheeled himself to the door. He moved manually, careful not to engage the motor. When he arrived at the door, he peered out. The hall was empty. Silently, Maximilian Kohler slipped out of the infirmary.